partner Alan Jacobs and myself are going to be talking about great streets and multi-way boulevards, presumably subject matters that everybody here is fairly well acquainted with. And so what we wanted to do, the way we structured our presentation, is that we will talk somewhat about issues that have come up in our practice and in our research that continue to be important that we wanted to reiterate again and just bring back to the table. But we also wanted to leave a lot of room where we could just have conversations about multi-way boulevards. Perhaps a number of you are working on multi-way boulevard projects or are considering them for some project that you're working on and might have some specific questions, and we could all have a dialogue with that. So that's what we're hoping to do, and that's why we're going to go ahead and get started now. So hopefully we'll have time for that. But I'm supposed to tell you before we get started that you do receive AIA credit for this session if you would like to get it, and that the forms are right up here on the corner of the table where the screen is right here. Okay, so you could pick those up after the session. And with no further ado, Alan Jacobs.
Hi. That's one hell of a view coming over of the Congress, Plaza Garage. That's a hell of a garage, isn't it? And then there's the one right behind it. So the whole block, I've never seen it like that. That beats Kansas City. On the other hand, you know, before you make fun of somebody else's city, you could come and see the San Francisco new federal office building and wonder about the scale of the city and what they had in mind. Nothing beats that, you know, for badness. But there you go. I'd like to start my part of our session by revisiting some of the basic qualities of the best streets and within the framework of cities and city life, to discuss some of the challenges and opportunities for ecological responsibility in street design, particularly we'll get to multi-way boulevards. Elizabeth will talk mostly about, as she said, some of the work we're doing, have been doing with others, and the opportunities, ecological opportunities with multi-way boulevards. I'd like to start by going back to some of my original work on streets. If you're engaged as educators, researchers, and in practice, as Elizabeth and I have been, an issue has to be confronted with some regularity. And I'm sure that you as professionals most have to do it all the time. That of details and decisions that seem too often to favor and result in making streets larger and wider. Officials seem always to want, and standards and norms seem always to dictate larger sizes, larger streets, larger blocks, larger buildings. So often, we as designers give in. We're so happy about getting the basic idea accepted that you give in on some of the details, and then if they get built, you look at them later and say, oh my God, you know, why did I do that? Why did I let that happen? The argument for smaller or narrower, the arguments are too seldom made within the design process. Big too often trumps small. So I think it's important occasionally to look back, to revisit findings and to see environmental opportunities within circumscribed spaces. This is San Francisco's Grant Street. And then the circumscribed space and the opportunities within it in Vancouver. We'll come back to that. The dictums of Corbusier and the modernists, as well as the Garden City folks, spurred on by slum clearance and redevelopment programs in the 1950s and beyond, generated beliefs and ideologies that fostered large, fostered large blocks with few and large streets and cul-de-sacs. But if you think about it, the best, most positively memorable urban space places are ones that have small blocks. And are lined with relatively modest size buildings. The more buildings, the better. One sees that in Old Nantucket. San Francisco, from the air, has many moderate size blocks and many, 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 many small buildings. Few beat the places where we were last year. Philadelphia skinny streets. Look how many buildings there are on a simple plaza in Copenhagen. On one of the really great streets, Queen Street in Toronto, that runs for 7 or 8 miles straight from one end of the city to the other, the stores are typically 16 feet wide, buildings 32, something like that. And it's an active street. They knew about those things, whether they did it consciously or not. In New York, the New York numbered streets here, though in Brooklyn, in Park Slope, with reasonably sized buildings, the best streets, the most positively memorable public realms tend to have many, many modest scale buildings. The streets have many entrances, many many entrances, many people looking after them, and they're lively. Repeatedly, I return to those square mile maps that I started really as a tangent as part of my great street studies of the 1980s and 1990s. They can teach so much about scale and the best urbanism. So there's Boston in the late 1800s. And the square mile, that's a square mile. And there's another square mile with the Big Dig, before the Big Dig, in the 1980s. It went from 618 intersections and 394 blocks in 1895 to 373 intersections and 245 blocks in less than 100 years. And that's the same area. Those two pictures up and down are of the same area. That's what was up above became what is below. That's the same area. You can spot a few of the same buildings. What happened to the 224 intersections and small streets and the 149 blocks? They went to bigness. And the public realm, by the way, disappeared. Think of some of the best cities generally esteemed in human scale and vibrancy. So Amsterdam has 578 intersections and 305 blocks in that square mile. And Savannah has 530 intersections and 399 blocks. Tokyo approaches 1,000 in that square mile with some just fine narrow streets. Philadelphia, of course. And then, given the dictums of the people we talked about, Brasilia, typically you get 92 intersections and in 47 blocks. And the winner of all is Irvine, with 15 intersections. Pretty good or bad. And then, or an Irvine residential area, as opposed to Portland, with 200-foot by 200-foot blocks, 370 intersections, 318 blocks, small blocks, 200 by 200. I don't know exactly. I think yesterday I counted as I was walking along. I think the blocks here go something like 300 foot square. I could be wrong. Many with an alley in between, so that helps it. So that's not bad in Austin. Small blocks and multiple intersections notwithstanding, it is instructive that many, even most streets in United States cities can be characterized as having wide streets. The streets of Portland are generally wide, 60 feet rights of way and 80 foot rights of way. San Francisco streets vary, but no one could call them small. And if you go out in the Richmond and Sunset districts, they are huge. Downtown San Francisco. Rarely do you get this kind of a street in San Francisco. Broadway Street in Vancouver, that we think about, as a great city, and it is. Vancouver Street rights of way are not characterized by narrowness. Nor is that, and we'll get back to that. That's 12th Street. In Vancouver. Manhattan numbered streets are 60 feet wide and the avenues 100 feet. Considering that a required physical quality of a good urban street is that it be defined, and that definition is achieved when the defining elements, mostly buildings, have a right-of-way of half the width of the right-of-way, it can be said, I think, not that, sorry. It can be said that many streets do not have that quality. And if buildings have generous setbacks from the rights of way, the problem of definition becomes more difficult. There are not many North American cities with narrow streets. Even, as I said, those skinny streets in central Philadelphia. It's hard to narrow existing rights of way. Trees, of course, and planting have long been the physical vehicles that have achieved street definition, as much as have buildings, as here in Shanghai, or on one of my favorite streets, Omote Sando, in Tokyo. Or in Vancouver, it's trees. As well, trees bring the best bang for the buck in street design if done well. And they're healthy, of course. That's in New York. While the rights of way in Vancouver may not be particularly narrow, the streets themselves, that is, curb to curb, can go as low as 24 feet with two parking lanes, and two-way traffic. That's pretty nifty. You wait, you queue. That's the 24-foot street, curb to curb. And then look what they do. They really begin to have space to make elegance, and always with those trees, on what they call the boulevard part, what I call the tree lawns. In Curtis Park area of Sacramento, they have curb-to-curb measurements, again, parking on both sides, two-way streets, 22 feet, including the two lanes of parking. Friedman Tung and Bottomley's wonderful design for Castro Street in Mountain View, California, is another way of defining and narrowing a street. In studies of San Francisco, we and others have found many, many potential ways to confront some of the design opportunities presented by overly wide streets. Not the least of those are lineal sitting and planting and water filtration areas in the centers of streets, not just islands. And in a place like San Francisco with loads and loads of curb cuts, you can put the parking against the median, the island. And so you get all the, you don't lose parking, you can gain it for the people, and these areas become somewhat protected. Like that. We've been working with others on the streetscape master plan in San Francisco on that. And like that. To return for a moment to an old idea. In San Francisco in, I guess that's the late 1960s, early 1970s, we did sidewalk extensions and tree plantings combined with angled parking in some overly wide streets in the DuBose Triangle area. At that time, all we did was the widening that you see, those bollards and the trees. Those benches and planters have been put there since by residents who have taken it as on their own, as their own. as they have done here in a mid-block widening. It's fascinating. We did that in the, as I said, the late 1960s, early 70s, and we tend to forget what these things can become. To some of you, that may look sloppy and messy. I love it. Good cities are sloppy and messy. Finally, a word or two about narrow multi-way boulevards. A perceived problem with multi-way boulevards is that they need lots of space, that they are wide. Well, they don't really have to be big, grand streets. And to go back so that you know what we're talking about, the center is the through-going realm, and the sides, with the side access roads, constitute the pedestrian realm and have to be designed for pedestrians as well as cars. Well, that's the Île-sur-le-Sorgue. In the Île-sur-le-Sorgue in France, that's the center realm, and you can just barely see, but you can see the two side realms. And those are small. Those are really small. In Ferrara, the Corso Isonzo, which is a full boulevard, is 87 feet wide. That's it. Works just fine. The Corso Vittorio Veneto in Ferrara is in the 90-foot category. Gracious Street has parking in the center of it. San Francisco Boulevard in Sacramento has a 100-foot width, and as you see, it that includes a total of 10 feet that are in the front yards of right-of-way of the adjoining buildings. So basically, they do it in 90 feet. And that's just a lovely, lovely residential street. Finally, the CG Road that we have talked about many times in Ahmedabad that we designed has a 100-foot right-of-way. We squeezed a lot of places. That's all the space we had. And it works just wonderfully, particularly the pedestrian realm. I love the people always walking in that street. They're doing what they should do. With that, we'll move on, and I'd like to turn it over to Elizabeth, who will take it from there.
So we have continued to be involved with the actual design of multi-way boulevards, and the first thing I wanted to do was to share with you a project that we've been working on with Friedman, Tung, and Bottomley, particularly with Greg Tung of that firm, and then also with some other wonderful engineers and some wonderful local planners in a small city north of Seattle, which is called Bothell, or maybe it's Bethel. I could never quite get that right. It's one of the cities in Washington where one of the new University of Seattle campuses is, or excuse me, University of Washington campuses is being built, and that's happening to the far side, a little bit off the off the map, but it's a typical kind of a situation where you have a small town with some remnants of, you know, that of the old downtown infrastructure still there, but you have a Washington State DOT roadway going right through the middle of it. And the DOT would like to widen that roadway, which would then further separate, you know, and further create a bigger barrier within the downtown. And so the idea here is to use a multi-way boulevard to allow for the through traffic to move more smoothly on the center roadway, but to also allow a re-knitting down, re-knitting back of the downtown. And I'll be happy to tell you that we've gotten pretty far along in the process, and I think we all feel really hopeful that Washington DOT is actually going to approve a multi-way boulevard for a Main Street situation. But we've gone through a number of issues with it. And just to make sure that you see where I'm talking about, this is the idea that this is where the Main Street would be, right through here. And the flow of traffic is coming up here and goes through the town and then continues on up. And this is what the street currently looks like. So it's a typical kind of condition that you see in a lot of these small towns. Some of the fabric has been lost over time, and the sort of remnant of the downtown shopping area is just a little bit off to the side of the of this main corridor. And that's what it looks like from above. So the idea is through building the multi-way boulevard, one can actually build in more more fabric along this street as well and create an extended downtown that would then bridge across this corridor to the other side of the downtown, which had sort of been isolated from the sort of remnants of the downtown shopping areas. Okay, so this would help strengthen this and then connect over to where city offices and the like are on the other side. And that's what the plan of it looks like. So we have a couple of state roads here. One is this one that continues to go on through, and that goes over towards where the new university is. But this is the one that DOT was interested in widening. So the right-of-way will be widened in this case, but instead of putting all of that new space into the through vehicle movement, it's going into creating these side access roads and this local realm. And then many of the buildings that are in this rendering seen lining the boulevard are actually proposed new structures. So it's a whole revitalization strategy as well as a street redesign strategy. And that's the image of what it could eventually look like. And where we started off when we got involved in the project is that the right-of-way that was being proposed was something like this. It was actually rather large. It was suggested that it would be a 160-foot right-of-way. And part of what was happening there is that there was going to be diagonal parking on the side and then a rather wide throughway, a 12-foot side access road, and then 12-foot lanes in, you know, for the center roadway. So it was kind of applying a lot of the typical kinds of standards to a multi-way boulevard. And when we got involved in the project, we made arguments against putting all that extra space into it. And a lot of that really comes from our experience with Octavia Boulevard, which we designed and is now built and operating in San Francisco, which a number of you might be familiar with. Well, we felt extraordinarily lucky to actually be able to build this multi-way boulevard in place of the central freeway that had been there. And we had to fight a lot of battles just to get the boulevard built because it was going to be the first time a multi-way boulevard had been built in the American context, you know, in decades and decades and decades. So we fought a lot of battles there, but there's some that we didn't fight as hard as we could have. And the one area that we didn't pursue was really this area, is in the side access road. We ended up going with a dimension of 18 feet to accommodate one through travel lane and one lane of parking, which is, you know, that was pushing it to try and get San Francisco to accept those dimensions. And we had to, as many of you might know, we had to play, or we had to do a lot of strategizing and a lot of negotiating with the fire chief, because they insisted that they would need to fight fires from the side access roadway instead of from the center roadway. And what that meant is that we designed the street so that the side median would have basically a mountable curb here, and we held the trees to the center roadway side, and that was the compromise, so that the fire engine vehicle could hop this curb, and that gave them enough space. But we still ended up with an overly wide roadway, and you can see it here. You can see it in the movement here, the amount of space around the vehicles. And the problem is that we just don't get quite enough traffic calming in there. And in the case in Octavia Boulevard, the side access roadways are a shared bicycle lane as well. So it's 12 feet is just a little bit too much room. The cars think that they can go, you know, beside the bicycle. And it can actually create a dangerous situation for the bicycle, the bicyclist moving there, because there's just a little bit too much room. So going back to Bothell, instead of this cross section, what we ended up doing was going down to dimensions that were like this. So we're actually proposing a 17-foot side access roadway that would have one lane of parallel parking along it. Because, of course, when you have the diagonal parking on the side access roadway, you need that backup space for the car, and you can't have a narrow roadway. But here we're able to narrow it down to 17 feet, and then the lanes in the center for the through-moving traffic are 11 feet wide, which is the same that we did on Octavia Boulevard. So we've gotten it down to 137-foot overall right-of-way, you know, which is great, because then there's a lot more of the land available for building the new frontage along the boulevard. Now, we would have liked to push it even further. This is as far as we're able to go with Washington DOT. Oh, and before I move on, let me just show you a couple of strategies that we use in this whole design process, which you might find useful for any work that you might be doing yourself, which is to simply do comparisons between the design that we were proposing for the new boulevard and other boulevards that exist, so that it would become a less threatening object. So I hope you can see that. This is just the plan comparison of Bothell Way, which is what we're trying to have the State Road 527 renamed as, so that it will, you know, feel like a local street, and a comparison of the traffic flows between it, which are anticipated, right? The anticipated flows, which are the whole reason why they want to widen this roadway, versus what's happening on Octavia Boulevard. So they're anticipating 36,000 cars a day versus Octavia, which is currently handling about 45,000 cars a day. And then on Octavia, we have much larger flows coming into it from the side as well. So this was a comparison that allowed the folks at Washington DOT to become somewhat comfortable with how the roadway could work. You know, now that we have an example with Octavia Boulevard, I think it makes it a lot easier for others later on. And then another comparison was to look at the spacing of intersections. Because, of course, on Multiway Boulevard, since we have these very complicated intersections with all the roadways coming together, especially when you design it as a traditional multiway boulevard where the side access roads continue all the way through the intersection instead of returning back to the center roadway at the intersection. So you've got all those roadways coming together. That's the classic form, and that's what we did with Octavia, and that's what is proposed for Bothell, because it makes sense, because the people that are on the side access roadway, they're doing local things, right? And to force them to go back out into the center roadway traffic and join all that through traffic doesn't make any sense. So in this situation, it's really critical to have those side access roadways continuing all the way straight through across every intersection. And in this case, we actually have wider spaced intersections than we did on Octavia Boulevard. We have the little alleys that come through, but they just come right into the side access roadway and don't go all the way through. So if you compare the length of the typical blocks, it's fairly similar to the typical blocks in Octavia Boulevard, and some of them are even longer. And then this parkway over here, that's the classic multi-way boulevard of all times. That's Ocean Parkway in Brooklyn. which has much, much narrower blocks. Okay? So this kind of comparison can actually be really, really helpful, I think, in any works that you might be doing, and we'd be happy to share this with you. We've also gathered just lots of information about all of these characteristics from many, many existing multi-way boulevards. But getting back to the dimensions of the side access roadway, we did a redesign for Pacific Boulevard in Vancouver, which is the main high street that goes through the new False Creek North neighborhood, one of the new high-density neighborhoods that Vancouver's been building around its downtown. That's what it looked like before we were brought in. The city had just designed it, and they realized that they had designed it too big, and they called us in to take a look at it and redesign it. So we designed it. It's in three different sections. There's a center median section here in the middle where the main retail area is, but on the areas on the side where there will be buildings fronting the street, residential buildings, those are one-sided multi-way boulevards. When I say one-sided, I mean that there's just an access road just on one side. And in this case, that made sense because there was only one side of the roadway where you would have direct access out of buildings onto a side access roadway. And that's the only reason to put one there. And also, we were constrained by right-of-way. So look at that. So this is just recently built. It's been there for about half a year or so now. That's what it looks like. It's 16 feet curb to curb on the side access roadway. And boy, does that make a difference. You know, you're not going to see cars trying to squeeze past a bicycle here on the side access roadway like you do on Octavia. And so it's a good example to point to, to point to for narrowness. And by the way, the buildings that line this side access road, they're tall buildings. There's a lot of density here. It's their typical building type of a point tower over podium based. So there's a lot of density that's coming out onto this roadway, and it still works. The other thing that I want to point out is some of the greening that's happened here. And we were able to do more with Pacific Boulevard in Vancouver than we were able to do with Octavia Boulevard by far. And this is really the direction that I think we need to go in with multi-way boulevards, is thinking about this whole side realm as the green street opportunity that's presented by the street type. Okay? Whether the side medians are narrow or wide, there are great opportunities for it. And the way that this boulevard was designed, when the cars do return back out into the center roadway at the intersection, and so the curb bulb out here was actually designed to be a rain garden, so it could actually help with water retention and water infiltration on site. And the greening of that place, the side median, is really just part of the way things are done in Vancouver. They have these, what they call the boulevard strips, everywhere in the city. And they're doing this in the downtown areas as well as in the neighborhood areas. So in terms of thinking about a transect and how the multi-way boulevard might, work in different parts of the city, I would still argue for a lot of greening techniques even when the street type is getting into the central city, and just really thinking of that side realm as a local residential street. And, of course, one of the great examples that we have of a green boulevard is the Esplanade in Chico, California, which is coming out of the downtown and going through a residential area. Now, they haven't done a lot of, the techniques that we think of today for really taking care of, water retention and filtration and all that. They've just basically left a lot of dirt and planted a lot of plants and a lot of trees. So they're doing it rather passively. And that's what the center roadway looks like. Right, so you get these kind of spaces, but there's all kinds of opportunities in boulevards to do so much more, especially in an urbanized area. And getting back to Octavia Boulevard, We did, you know, some of it, just in terms of keeping the side medians relatively permeable. So we have permeable paving on that median. But we weren't able to take it further, because what we really wanted to do was to have this whole realm be pervious. Right? So this should have been a different paving material, not asphalt, but something else. And we just weren't able to push it that far. Part of it is cost, right? It always falls out of the budget with cost. But part of it is just not, you know, not pushing it as far as we could have. And we both look back at the project and we think, why didn't we take it that next step further? So with the Streetscapes Master Plan that we and others have been preparing for San Francisco, one of the street typologies, of course, that we're looking at is the multi-way boulevard. And as you can see in this plan, the idea here is that that is considered a very separate realm. And so it is, you know, a realm that you think of as a Werner. And you really have to conceive of it as this extraordinarily slow-moving realm. And that then leads to the obvious idea that all of this can be permeable paving and all of this can be a green area. So look at all the opportunities presented in that opportunity. And in San Francisco now, we're recommending, should there be another multi-way boulevard that's built, to go with a 16-foot side access roadway. So this plan has not yet been approved by San Francisco, but hopefully these ideas and suggestions will make it all the way through the process and be adopted by all the agencies. And then once that's done, this would be a document that you all could, you know, refer to and use as an example of, you know, how to design a really good multi-way boulevard. One of the things that we spent a lot of time with in that Streetscapes Master Plan is all the different green streets possibilities that could happen and all the different types of things that could be done. Of course, you know them all, the permeable paving, the flow-through and infiltration planters, swales, rain gardens, various channels and runnels, infiltration and soakage trenches, and infiltration area boardwalks as well. And in our typology of streets that we've come up with, this is the multi-way boulevard. So under these special landscape streets, and you'll notice that all of those kind of processes make a lot of sense for this category of street type. And of course, one can think about some of the typical greening examples that, you know, come from the Northwest, which are very, very lush. But in San Francisco, we're thinking about greening in other ways. You know, we're looking at this type of an environment, which is really about, you know, infiltration and retention, or these kinds of environments that are with more native materials and more some xeriscaping types of opportunities. And some more. A number of these are ones that have been done in the Mission in San Francisco. And, of course, lots and lots of opportunities for the different types of paving that might be used in different areas. I'm sure you're all familiar with these. You know, and thinking about the design opportunities that are inherent in how you design these side spaces. You know, why not? And again, a rain garden, which if you get into a situation where you can't win the fight, or maybe where you don't think it's absolutely necessary for the side access roads to go all the way through on the multi-way boulevard, but then they could return to the center, the idea of using that bulb-out space as some kind of a rain garden really makes a lot of sense. Okay, and this is another wonderful idea which could find its way into multi-way boulevards, where you actually allow this landscape zone to go under a boardwalk area. This is another example of it. So you could, you know, either in the median or, you know, if you didn't want that to be a planted area for some reason, say you really wanted there to be benches out there on the side median, or if it was a place where maybe there's transit stops, bus stops or something like that, so that you need a surface that people can walk on, you can still create this permeable area by putting a boardwalk that's raised up over this infiltration trench and still accomplish the you know, the same thing, so that you can have a walkable surface basically on the whole median, or this could be on the sidewalk as well, but you still have that trench area. So there's, of course, all kinds of opportunities now with things like structural grass and structural soil, opportunities to be taken advantage of. But because, of course, one of the wonderful things about the fact that there's not very much traffic on the side access roadways means that it's the ground, the surface, is not likely not going to be as compacted as it will be in the center roadway. But if you really want trees to grow, you really, really have to be careful about what's going on underneath the surface, right? So on the side where you would want the tree roots to be growing out into the center of the roadway, putting structural soil in place is a really, really important idea. Maybe a little less important on the side access roadways because of the lower amount of traffic, but a good idea as well. And this was just a shot that we took when we were in Seattle last week. And, you know, the opportunities for special seasonal displays and things like that are very possible. Now, of course, in this case, the way it's been designed, it's not working for very much for infiltration or retention, and you'll even notice that there's watering lines along that. So the opportunity to really design it so that it works ecologically and is not just an aesthetic thing really presents itself. And I just wanted to end with this image, which comes from some of the work that Patrick Condon up at UBC has done about sustainable streets. And just remembering that what we're doing here and the real opportunity with these multi-way boulevards is to create what's going to be the urban forest in 30 years. And remembering back to the images that Jake showed of the DuBose triangle, you know, which was just a simple thing in a lot of ways to get those widened median spaces that people could then inhabit and take over time. And the idea that, you know, that's where we're going to eventually, and that these streets, if we can build them, have such an opportunity to get us to a situation where we really contribute to the urban forest and all of the things that it does for us in terms of reducing the urban heat island effect, et cetera, et cetera. So hopefully when you're thinking multi-way boulevards, you're thinking about that image over on the right of where they can eventually go. So that's the end of our presentation. And now what we'd like to do is just open it up and have a conversation about multi-way boulevards, great streets, your projects, or whatever.
Yes.
Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. I can't reiterate enough how important the greening of the boulevard. We, in Indianapolis, where I work, are doing the multimodal system plan, and it's a critical aspect, putting back boulevards and reinventing the city beautiful to help us get back into compliance with the EPA, ozone, particulate matter, et cetera. So that's just, you can't overstress how important the green canopy and moving all that through.
Has everybody been hearing what he said? No. The importance of the green canopy, the importance of going back to Boulevard to Indianapolis, excuse me. And he's stressing the importance of that they are trying to get back to. To meet compliance with current, you know, norms.
Well, my question for you has more to do with the parking lane and management of that with bikes in particular. Our bike coalition, we're using striping so that we can get the extra width without giving it to the cars, but allowing it for the emergency vehicle. And we have the back and angle parking that we're trying to do. Unfortunately, there's, you know, the cost of space. I mean, this is an existing urbanized area, so getting the space is kind of precious. My question for you then is the there's been talk about having right turn lanes go through this parking lane if you're going to turn right, because of we're going from three lanes each direction, trying to encourage them to go down two, and so they're asking if they could offload some of the right angle. Would you advise against that, or how could we manage to handle the traffic flows that they're afraid that we're going to lose and still get the boulevard put back there?
Right. So I take that one?
Yeah. We have to say the issue is how to handle both bikes and traffic by at the same time as you're taking off traffic and trying to narrow the number of lanes, have fewer lanes.
Right, and a big concern seems to be that your client wants to have to think about the side access road as a place where the right turns could be channeled into, right? Our experience of multi-way boulevards is that that's a bad idea, because then you're putting, you know, that through traffic movement on the side access road, so it's no longer just the local access road. And so the messages start to get, you know, very mixed, and so that can become an unsafe situation. Plus the fact that probably where that ends up leading you is to putting, you know, sleeves or something like that through the median so that people go over into the side lane because maybe they don't want to do it the block before, et cetera, et cetera. And then the more moves like that you make, the more you totally destroy the side realm. And there's examples of that that have been done. K Street in Washington, D.C. is a big one, and that's what they did, and it really screwed it up. So you need to fight for the fact that to not do it that way. And yes, there's complexity at the intersections when you have the right turn, right, going in front of this. Right, but because it's a relatively slow environment, that's why it works, right? Because the bicyclist, I was just talking with my friend Jeff Tumlin about this yesterday, and how why it works in San Francisco is because the bicyclists, they're coming up to that, and they do have to stop in this case because there's a stop sign at every intersection. And the car, if it's making a right turn and it has that median space, right, there's enough time if a bicyclist were to not notice what's happening back here that the car would actually be able to stop. So you're not creating a situation where you have fatalities with bicyclists. And we could talk more about that if you want.
I would also point out that if you don't know, just in terms of options, things that are being done, I know that God forbid you should ever tell an American city audience that use a European example. They don't want to hear that. They don't know anything, those people. You know, it's bad enough to use an example of another city, you know, further away. Oh, you know, that's a different culture.
Yeah.
Nonetheless.
San Francisco.
Nonetheless. Pay attention. And a place that I would really pay attention to, and hey, it could be fun, cost you a lot of money, but to is Paris, particularly in terms of bike lanes and in terms of putting more and more in the right-of-way, including more trees. They have been doing it in the last 4 or 5 years in a spectacular way. At the same time as they put in new bus lanes and mixing things that are just magnificent. They put the bike lane on its, with a curb, so it's its own lane, against the median. They'll do that. Parking, then sometimes against the bike lane, but there's that still that curb. And they do things like that and are doing them more and more and more, and it's very exciting stuff. In some ways, better and more exciting relative to bicycles than in a couple of the Scandinavian countries, really, which is shocking, you know, in Netherlands and Denmark. because they're combining a lot of stuff. That lady, we'll try to make this quicker. In the center, you mean?
Yes, because I saw your Vancouver example, I think, where it looked like there were bike lanes adjacent to the travel lane, and then you had the opportunity to ride the slide rail if you chose to. But if it's retail with a high parking, it's probably not as appropriate for bicycling. So what were your thoughts on that?
Where do you put the bicycle? Do you put the bicycle in the center, or do you put the bicycle in the side realm, particularly if it's a commercial street?
Right.
And in truth, I would put it on the side realm almost every time, unless you could make a very separate realm for it. I'd put it in the side realm and let the bikes go. Even with what? Yeah.
Can I step in? I might answer that just a little bit differently, because I think it actually depends upon different situations. In Vancouver, it was really important to use this particular route as a through route for commuting bicycles. So it was really important for them to have that bike lane. And it actually is a fairly safe place, because they don't have to worry about the car doors opening in it. And so in truth, we were able to do that with a fairly narrow bicycle lane. So we weren't adding so much room to the center roadway. But on the other hand, they were also allowing us to do the center lanes as 3-meter-wide lanes, which is a little less than 10 feet. So our overall center realm wasn't that wide. You know, if you've got 12-foot lanes in the middle plus a 5 or 6 foot bicycle lane, that's a much wider space that pedestrians have to cross. So if you can get all the dimensions down, it doesn't add so much. But again, in Vancouver, we were handling two types of bicycles, the through commuters in the center, and then the more casual cyclists on the side realm. And there, it doesn't matter so much if they're slowed down and they're stopped. And, you know, there's some of those, there are cars coming in, and it just doesn't matter as much. It just mixes up.
Is the bicycle community considered a stakeholder?
Yeah, in the Great Streets plan process, in the cities.
Depending on where you are, in San Francisco, there's no way that bikeholders are not going to be considered a stakeholder. You know, that it's just just that simple.
And the wonderful thing in San Francisco was that the Bicycle Coalition got it. They understood that we needed to keep the boulevard as narrow as we possibly could, not fill up the whole former freeway right-of-way, because of the importance of building new frontage along the boulevard, even though some of those lots were only going to be, 15 feet, even narrower wide. They got it. They understood what we kept saying was, no one gets everything, everyone gets a lot. No one gets everything, everyone gets a lot. And so they understood the importance in this case for the local neighborhood of getting a street that was going to work right. And so they were willing to accept something that wasn't optimum. And, that's what we have to get to, is balance, and not everybody optimizing, because then you can never get a good street, right? It just doesn't work. So
we're going to go here and then to the lady. Yes. Chico question?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
We're fighting the effort to actually continue to do things right in the face of an opportunity to screw them up. Right?
They do. They're trying, aren't they?
But we figured the thing to do would be to solve the problem by making it better. So what we're pressing for right now, now that we're fighting the side ride issue, is to say, wait a minute. Hold on to that, and let's talk about the next section of the Esplanade that we need to go right away. And that right away is 90 feet, which would work with the two side drives, no center median.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any points of particular concern when you're making a shift from a center median to no center median? You're still
lots of ways of doing it. Where do you put streetcars is a question. The question of center median or not having a center median. Yeah. There are some the Brooklyn boulevards work just terrifically with no center median. Both
Eastern Parkway and Ocean Parkway.
Ocean Parkway. You know, Ocean Parkway has three lanes in each direction and carries just huge amounts of traffic in the center. There's no median.
Mm-hmm. It's about 75,000 cars a day.
You know, Eastern carries less, but there's no central median. I have to admit that I think that it, in the case of San Francisco, the central median was a given. Had to be, because that was one of the things that people had voted on.
It was actually in the EIR.
Before we got into the design. And there are places where I wish it weren't there. But then the issue, we'll get there soon. This lady is after me. The next question, the next issue is with the tracks. Where do you put the streetcar tracks? I've played with them all kinds of ways, you know, in terms of design. I haven't built any. I haven't any of those built. I tend to like to put them and confine space to put them in the medians, in the side access median, to put it there, so that I know that runs counter to putting them in the center of the whole right-of-way, but there are space considerations, and then you deal with the median, with the side access medians, and gives you all kinds of opportunities, and people aren't walking as far. Granted, if you're coming from the far side of the street, you're walking further, but I think that works best. Those work best. Madam.
I'm from New Hampshire, and even when we can win the battle with the fire chief, there's the issue of snow storage. Where does the snow go? And the whole idea that any additional impediment might be another median is a real problem in moving snow.
Yeah, so the question is, what about in cold weather places where there's snow? How do you deal with the snow storage on multi-way boulevards? I have to admit that I am not familiar with the actual spatial dimensions needed for moving the snow. My sense would be that you could do something maybe, I don't know, a little bit similar to what was done on St. George Street in Toronto. Are you familiar with that redesign that was done, where they actually built these sort of planters that were on the side? So the green space area that we think of as the green zone could also be built as a place where there was snow storage. So it could either be on the, you know, between the sidewalk and the side access road. It seems to me it would make sense if you can get the snow plow vehicle in there. You know, and that comes back to the whole question of the craziness of overscaling all of our vehicles. You know, so then one has to fight the war for the smaller snowplow. And I don't know if that helps you or not, but what is the dimension of your of the vehicle?
We have three snowplows from 4 feet to 12 or 14 feet. So I thought the plow could be physical.
The storage. Yeah, so I think I would put it, as I said, in the zone between the side access road and where the sidewalk is.
Elizabeth had a different answer to my answer earlier.
We don't always agree.
And now I have a different answer than she. I'm reminded of my friend Jaime Lerner from Curitiba, who said, you know, if you have all the answers before you'll start, you'll never start. You didn't have all the, think of all the narrow roads, or not so narrow roads, that got built, and no one thought about getting rid of the snow. And somehow, then the snow came, and they got rid of the snow. I think you could go crazy trying to figure the answer to that out, and I think you would screw up almost any street if you make that a design criteria. I would, and for all of the Department of Public Works engineers who tell you that as a reason for making it wider, because that's what that's what you face, then you have to go to them and say, you go out and you get 7 million pictures and bring them back the next day where the streets aren't wide and they somehow manage. You know, what do you mean? And you're going to have me redesign the damn street for that? You know, ultimately, I know I'm, going over the top here, but it takes a little of that. See, look at the questions. There was a gentleman way back there that was interrupting. No, that one. Yeah. I can hear it. Can you hear it? Terrific. Am I here?
You have to talk louder. Great, thank you. So were people able to hear that? The comment was that maybe thinking about whether or not a central median was necessary has to do with whether there's an axial perspective or that you're looking at something at the end of the street and the like. I guess what we'd probably come down on is that we usually don't like throwing extra space into the roadway, so not doing it if you can. Right, but if you do have a boulevard that has three lanes in each direction, it can be challenging to cross without having some kind of a refuge in the middle. With two lanes in each direction, you don't need it. I think is where I'd come down on. Yeah.
All of the questions have come from this side, I guess, so I apologize. Way back there, and then this gentleman, but yes. Speak loudly because I can't hear a thing.
Well, presumably the development that's along, the question had to do with an existing situation in Milton Keynes where there's some existing multi-way boulevards, but local people would like to get rid of the side access roads and the medians and just bring the development out to narrow the overall right-of-way.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so it's not owned by the public? It's not part of the public right of way? Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. All the cases that we've seen, the side access road has actually been part of the right of way. And is it just because the developers want to get more land to so they could develop bigger parcels? Yes. Right. So it sounds like you just have to, you know, you guys value the side access roadways, and you have to, yeah, that you have to fight for them. You know, you
sounds
just have
like
to fight for them.
Screen blowing murder time.
Yeah. You know, so you can use all the things that we keep trying to say. You know, we need it needs to be a local space as well as a, you know, a through movement space, and that allows it. Well, you know, that's crazy. I mean, there's all kinds of arguments that one could get into with the value of trees, you know, aesthetically. And there's all kinds of studies that have been done that show the value to retail areas, if it's a retail area, for trees to be there. Right. Well, I think that that's a case of sort of applying a sort of universal truism to a street type where it doesn't make sense to do it, right? And not understanding that this is a different street type with this local access road. You know, if you'd like to talk about it further, you could contact me. I'm actually doing a big research study right now where we're gathering all the literature having to do with why, you know, the different values of trees and traffic calming, et cetera, that's going to be available at a website at UC Berkeley. So they might give you some ammunition that you could use. So you could contact me.
Yeah. This gentleman, then we have to quit. Not so bad.
With the comments on the European street, particularly an example of a completely narrow boulevard that was not in this slide, although maybe in some other slides you can show, is in towards Mirabelle, A in Provence.
X.
S in Provence, okay.
Cour Mirabeau. Thank you. I think, sadly, for us, we run our time limit. Thank you so much. Thank you for your questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first thing is, do you have the book, the Boulevard book? Yeah, okay. So that has a lot of the basic research. And to go back and reiterate some of that, you know, just those points again and again might help. Another thing is that we did a video when we were doing the research that's available through the Institute of Urban and Regional Development. It's a 20-minute video that just shows the different types of multi-way boulevards that are actually, you know, functioning today. And that's really useful for people who don't know what the street type is, so they can actually see it. You know what you should do is go to IURD, which is the Institute of Urban and Regional Development. Just Google IURD and at Berkeley. And then they have a listing of their publications and resources. And there's one thing you can click on that says video. And ours will be one of the few videos that comes up.